Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Gail Harrison for Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan is urging the Security Council to approve an immediate peacekeeping force for Liberia. His request cites a rapid deterioration of conditions in the war-shattered African nation. Liberia's main rebel groups declared a ceasefire yesterday, but the government of Charles Taylor quickly rejected the proposed terms, and the fighting continued. More than a million people are now trapped in Liberia's capital city, Monrovia. Reports today say that starvation is becoming a serious problem as supplies of food are nearly exhausted. We'll hear from that desperate city in a moment. But first, as Liberia waits, the nations likely to make up a peacekeeping force negotiate. Maggie Farley is UN Bureau Chief for the LA Times. She joins us to talk about the talks. Hi, Maggie.
Hi.
Well, remind us, the U.S. has 2,000 Marines stationed in ships off the coast of Liberia. Nigeria has said that it is ready to send two battalions of troops, 1,500 total. What's the holdup?
Money. It all comes down to money. Nigeria says that it was left holding the bag for the last time it intervened with peacekeepers, not for the U.N. And this time it wants to make sure that other people are going to pay for it. The United States has already pledged $10 million to help with getting the troops there to Liberia and sustaining them for a little while, but that's only about a tenth of what the estimated cost will be to keep them there for 6 months.
Right. Well, as that continues to be hung up, Kofi Annan is urging the Security Council to approve a force for immediate deployment. Is he speaking about Nigeria, or does he mean the United States?
First, he wants the Nigerians to go. And they'll go in two ships. There's a battalion in Sierra Leone that's just finishing up their peacekeeping mission there. They'll go first. Then another battalion will come from Lagos, Nigeria. The $10 million that the U.S. has pledged will help get that second battalion there. What Secretary General Kofi Annan is proposing is that the Security Council allow them to divert money from the Sierra Leone peacekeeping mission to fund the Nigerians' movements to Liberia and to keep them there. This is highly unusual, to take money from another peacekeeping mission for a non-UN peacekeeping mission. Mm. They're not representing the UN. They're going as part of a Western African force.
And whose money is that that would be diverted?
It's UN member states' money. Mm. A quarter of it, or a little bit less than a quarter of it, comes from the United States. But this is also the British-led, the Sierra Leone mission is led by the British, and so they're probably not going to be very happy about diverting money from what has been a successful mission under their lead.
Right. Well, the Secretary General also called for a force with a robust mandate. What does that mean?
That means that they should have a Chapter 7 mandate. They should be allowed to use their full force, to use their guns, to protect civilians, to protect themselves, the full battery of force that they can use.
Maggie, you mentioned Liberian President Charles Taylor. Yesterday he seemed to indicate that he wasn't in a hurry to leave. How much is he affecting the negotiations about forces going in?
Oh, his waffling is causing a lot of instability in the capital, and it's making the Americans gnash their teeth. There's a very tightly choreographed plan for all of the peacekeepers to come in, and it's all dependent on Charles Taylor leaving.
Yeah. And we've also been talking about money. President Obasanjo of Nigeria also seemed to indicate that given enough money, his troops and West African troops could do the job and wouldn't even need U.S. troops.
Well, that would be ideal from the U.S. point of view, that they could just write a check and not actually have to muddy their boots on the ground. But President Obasanjo has criticized the U.S. reluctance to actually come in. He said that their offer is like saying, if your house is on fire and somebody says, here I am, I have my water, my fire engine, now when you put the fire out in your house, I'll come in. Hmm. He said, I wonder what sort of help that is, with all due respect.
Well, Maggie, thank you.
You're welcome.
Maggie Farley is the LA Times UN Bureau Chief. She spoke to us from New York.
Well, as you've just heard, many Liberians are waiting with increasing desperation for someone, anyone, to put an end to their civil war. One of them is the Reverend Moses Pah, a Baptist minister in Liberia's capital city of Monrovia. When we got through to Moses late yesterday, he told us that more than 400 people had sought refuge from the fighting at his home. But even there, shells were falling. One of them killed 9 of his neighbors. Moses told us there was no more food, only tea to drink, and that people are beginning to die. We should note the sound quality on the line from Liberia is not up to our usual standards. So, Moses, can you just tell us what the situation is where you are right now?
It's terrible. It's terrible. People are dying by the hundreds. We have rockets falling indiscriminately. Right now, we have over 460 persons in a little squeezed building. And because of the shelling, the indiscriminate shelling, people are not able to go outside to get food and water.
Moses, I understand there are some 400 people crowded into your home. Why did they come to your house?
They came to find safety. But right now, I will tell you, there's no place to be safe here in Liberia. Where they thought it was safe is where the rockets are coming. We don't even know who is throwing these rockets. And people are just dying. We don't know what to do now.
So you have no food at all, no water?
No food at all. I mean, tea. Can you imagine you have to take tea, boil it with no sugar, and just drink it and see if you can, you know, make it up to the next day? If you see some of the people, it's terrible.
How close are you to the fighting?
We are not too far away, really, 3 or 4 kilometers from that area.
And there are shells flying overhead right where you are?
Exactly. Right behind the house where we are lodging, it broke one house right at the back of our house, killing all the people there. And right down the road of where 9 persons, just one stroke, 9 persons are out washing and cooking their breakfast, were just wiped out.
Moses, what do you want to happen there?
The only thing we have been crying for is we want the peacekeepers. Let me tell you this. The Americans are the ones we have been crying on to come and help us. I would also like to say, if the fighting forces are listening, I mean, if the peacekeepers are listening to us, we will welcome them. We will welcome them. Even the fighters here, they will never harm them. They will not shoot at them. They will welcome them. They themselves are saying they are fighting. They should come right now. They will be welcome. Please, let them come.
Well, we will convey your message as best we can. Thank you, Moses.
Okay. As we were speaking to you, everybody is on the ground just looking at me and just wishing that something happened. Something happened. But you're not saying next week or next day, let it come now. Please, please, please.
We are dying.
The Reverend Moses Pah spoke to us yesterday from Monrovia, where more than 400 desperate people have taken shelter in his home.
The state, known for its earthquakes, is experiencing something of the sort politically. Weeks after a budget was due, California lawmakers, locked in their chambers for 2 days, finally passed a budget yesterday, one that addresses a record deficit while avoiding tax increases. Governor Gray Davis said it could have been a whole lot uglier. Well, it's about to get uglier. He has to now campaign full-time to defeat a recall election in October. For the latest on the mess in California, we turn to John Myers. He's reporter for NPR member station KQED in San Francisco. And, John, I know you're based in the state capital, Sacramento, where these locked-up lawmakers fought for, 29 and a half hours to pass the budget. What was it like?
Well, Robin, it was one of the most interesting sessions I've ever covered as a reporter. It was the longest legislative session in California history, broke a record that dates back to 40 years. The Speaker of the State Assembly here in Sacramento literally locked the members of the legislature in the building. They could brush their teeth, go up to their offices for that. That's about all. Many of them slept on the floor and on couches, but they got this budget passed, and we had a $38 billion shortfall in here in California. We're still going to have about an $8 billion shortfall once this is all over next year, but clearly some very difficult decisions about spending cuts and also no tax increases. So Republicans in California won a bit of a victory on that one.
Well, and how so? Increased fees, spending cuts, as you said, no taxes. How is this good news for Gray Davis?
Well, the conventional wisdom has been if the budget got passed sometime soon, the governor's chances in a recall election go up because his opponents couldn't say the state continues to muddle through without any financial plan. However, the problem is that the budget news isn't particularly good. We still, as I said, have an $8 billion shortfall in California next year. A lot of people unhappy with the plan. And California politics has become quite polarized, which is probably part of the equation behind the recall election, quite polarized between ideologies of Republicans and Democrats. And there's a lot of fighting still about the budget plan that was even signed. So whether it helps the governor enough remains to be seen.
And now it looks as if there are fissures in the Democratic Party, which had been united behind Governor Davis. And now there are two Democrats calling for Dianne Feinstein to put her name on the ballot to run against Davis. One of them saying it's no secret that he can't survive the recall effort. So now that's not good. Let's take a look at that recall. A judge made an important ruling yesterday about the ballot. Can you tell us briefly about that?
Well, Robin, the California recall ballot has two parts. Question one will be, do you want to recall the governor? Question two, who should replace the governor should he be recalled? The ruling was that is that voters don't have to vote on the first question if they're going to vote on the second one. And before, they had been told they had to vote on the first one in order to vote on the second one.
That's
now it's really split the two questions apart. And the other pending case, of course, is whether or not a successor election should even be held. Some claim that the lieutenant governor of California is the only one who gets to step in if the governor gets kicked out.
Well, that's fascinating, but it seems as if the judge was saying everyone should be able to vote on a successor, even if you don't vote on the recall. So we could set up a situation where Gray Davis survives the recall, but somebody wins because more people have voted for a candidate to replace him.
It's absolutely possible. And the hardest part that some people have had with dealing with the vagaries of recalls is that the governor could lose, say, with 49% of the vote, because it's a simple majority. He could lose with 49% of the vote. His successor could be elected with a fraction of that number because there will be so many candidates on the ballot. It's never been done before. It's certainly uncharted territory for California.
Mm. Well, John, if you can stay awake, please keep watching it for us.
We will. Thanks so much.
John Myers, Sacramento Bureau Chief for NPR member station KQED.
Just ahead, author Sherman Alexie on his new collection of short stories, 10 Little Indians.
And later in the program, Boston's new archbishop makes a passionate plea to his flock.
There's more coming up here and now.
We'll be right back.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
Sherman Alexie writes about the lives of Native Americans with an often humorous eye. In his most famous work, the screenplay for the 1998 film Smoke Signals, two American Indians travel off the reservation, and in a memorable scene, one has to teach the other how to be, as he puts it, a real Indian.
You gotta look mean or people won't respect you. White people will run all over you if you don't look mean. You gotta look like a warrior. You gotta look like you just came back from killing a buffalo.
But our tribe never hunted buffalo. We were fishermen.
What? You wanna look like you just came back from catching a fish? This ain't Dances with Salmon, you know. Thomas, you gotta look like a warrior.
Well, the search for what it means to be Indian, and in fact what it means to be human, is at the core of Sherman Alexie's newest work, a collection of short stories titled Ten Little Indians. And Sherman Alexie joins us from the studios of KUOW in Seattle. Welcome, Sherman.
Hey, thank you. It's good to be here. Or wherever I am.
Wherever you are, in a studio at the moment, I trust. So, Dances with Salmon, I mean...
Yeah, well, you know, it's all, you know, most popular images of Indians focus on the plains and the buffalo, so it's always fun to, you know, slam on the plains Indians a little bit. So Dances with Salmon would be a much better movie, more existential, you know, there'd be more under the surface.
Well, let's talk for a moment about your newest work. Why the title, Ten Little Indians?
I just thought it's funny, and I also like reappropriating images of Indians. So by taking that away from the nursery rhyme and from Agatha Christie and from, you know, pop culture, I can sort of claim it for my own and reinvent it.
And now, why is it that the people in your book always refer to themselves as Indians? You know, Native Americans has become the more PC term.
Well, it's because Indians call each other Indians. It's pretty simple. Most Indians only use Native American in mixed company. But they're interchangeable for me.
It's also interesting, as I read your stories, these are people for whom being Indian means both everything and nothing. I mean, they could be anyone, and yet their sensibilities are obviously affected by the fact that they are Indian.
Well, Indians in this country are caught in a strange, ironic situation of being indigenous to the land and yet also being immigrants into its culture by being colonized, by being separate and sovereign, by choice and by force. And therefore, you know, this late in the 20th century, this early in the 21st century, as we become more assimilated, the Native American story is really an immigrant's tale.
There's a wonderful section from The Search Engine, one of the, actually the first story in the collection. I wonder if you'd read that. It really speaks to that that ironic view, I think, of both white people and Indians.
White people, no matter how smart, were too romantic about Indians. White people looked at the Grand Canyon, Niagara Falls, the full moon, newborn babies, and Indians with the same goofy sentimentalism. Being a smart Indian, Corliss had always taken advantage of this romanticism, but that didn't mean she wanted to share the refrigerator with it. If she lived with a white person, Corliss knew she'd quickly be seen as ordinary, because she was ordinary. It's tough to share a bathroom with an Indian and continue to romanticize her. If word got around that Corliss was ordinary, even boring, she feared she'd lose her power and magic. She knew there would come a day when white folks finally understood that Indians are every bit as relentlessly boring, selfish, and smelly as they are. And that would be a wonderful day for human rights, but a terrible day for Corliss.
That's such a great passage. And also in this short story, The Search Engine, you write about your character Corliss, who is a reader, who loves the magic of books and of words, and is so excited when she finds a book by an Indian writer and then goes to great lengths to track him down. So you can understand why, for her, this was such an important discovery. You know, look, I'm not the only one.
Well, the strange thing is that Native Americans are everywhere in pop culture, but it's a specific sort of image. It's, you know, the feathers and war paint. It's the environmental New Age savior, and it has nothing really to do with reality. So in this story, when Corliss reads poems that are contemporary about the place where she grew up, written from a Spokane Indian perspective, she goes nuts. She chases this guy down. You know, she calls it her own odyssey.
How important is it to you to use humor? Because it's the theme that runs throughout many of these stories. They're not necessarily funny stories by any means, but the characters really do manage, for the most part, to look at the world and smile. It may be an ironic smile, but there's a fair bit of humor in how they see the world.
You know, I don't know. For me, humor has never been an option. I just grew up in a funny family, a funny tribe, a funny culture. So, you know, I can certainly look at it from an objective standpoint, but it's still, the fact is that I don't know how to be anything else. And the characters struggle with that idea of being funny in serious situations. And it's been really interesting that this book has received, you know, amazingly positive reviews, but those few negative reviews have always focused on the fact that the stories are too funny. You know, that phrase has been used.
Is that a negative? How is it possible to be too funny in a bad way?
I don't know. But, you know, in my personal life, I know as soon as somebody says that it's an inappropriate time to be funny, I know that's exactly the time when you should be funny.
As you go around the country, I understand that very often at readings or somewhat frequently at readings, you are asked, do you hate white people? And why do you suppose that is?
Well, you know, that's sort of, you know, that really started around the Indian Killer book, which was a feel-good novel about interracial murder. The Time magazine review at the time referred to the book and me as septic with his own unappeasable anger, which I put on a T-shirt and play basketball in.
That's a memorable line.
I know, it's great. You know, certainly I am angry politically about Indian life. But one thing I think has happened that people have seen is that my politics are much broader than just Indian concerns. I worry about poor people and oppression and racism and sexism and all the other negative isms there are. So I think my work has reflected that. And this book, Ten Little Indians, there's much more diversity, and there are all sorts of kind and decent white people in it.
Well, Sherman Alexie, it's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you.
Writer Sherman Alexie joined us from Seattle. For a more extended reading from his new book, Ten Little Indians, you can go to our website, here-now.org.
John Wayne's tea, John Wayne's tea, are they plastic or are they steel?
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, a new bishop is installed in Boston's troubled archdiocese. He's known as Mr. Fix-It, but wants to be called Archbishop Sean.
The Vatican issues a reminder to Catholic politicians to say no to any gay marriage legislation.
When I think about what the church is standing for, or should stand for, the acceptance and openness, I have to say that it's kind of contradictory.
Also, what to do with all that summer corn? Chef Kathy Gunst cooks up a solution.
These stories coming up, Here and Now.
I'm Gina Cervetti. Today marks a key point in the clergy sex abuse scandal. The Archdiocese of Boston, where the scandal mushroomed a year and a half ago, installs a new leader to replace the ousted Cardinal Bernard Law. Tony Randolph has the story.
Archbishop Sean Patrick O'Malley says it won't be business as usual as he asks for forgiveness from victims of clergy sex abuse. In his first homily in his new position, O'Malley said the entire Catholic community is ashamed of the pain caused by the scandal, and he said the church is working to create a safe environment. Some victims of clergy sex abuse were among the more than 2,000 people who attended the installation ceremony. Others refused invitations and instead rallied outside the Cathedral of the Holy Cross. The cases of some 500 alleged clergy sex abuse victims are still pending. I'm Tony Randolph in Boston.
President Bush has held a wide-ranging news conference this morning at the White House in which he touched on issues from tax cuts to the war in Iraq. The president for the first time accepted personal responsibility for the false claim made in his State of the Union address that Iraq was trying to purchase uranium in Africa.
I take personal responsibility for everything I say, of course. Absolutely. I also take responsibility for making decisions on war and peace.
Asked about the issue of gay marriage, the president said marriage is between a man and woman and that the federal government should codify that. The CIA says an audio tape aired on Arab television yesterday probably is the voice of Saddam Hussein. In the tape, the man identified as the ousted Iraqi leader acknowledges the deaths of his sons last week. U.S. intelligence officials also say two previous Saddam tapes are probably authentic. British Prime Minister Tony Blair says he has work to do to convince the British public that the war in Iraq was justified. Blair told reporters he'll have to make a case on the issues of weapons of mass destruction and the improvement of the quality of life in Iraq. And Liberia's military chief says the fighting is still heavy in Monrovia, despite rebel pledges for a ceasefire. The rebels had agreed earlier to pull back and await the arrival of international peacekeepers, but the Liberian government says the rebels are now trying to cross into government-held central Monrovia. On Wall Street, the Dow is down 16 points and the Nasdaq off 9. You're listening to Here and Now.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
While the clergy sex abuse scandal has affected Catholic dioceses across the country, nowhere has it had a greater impact than Boston, where today Bishop Sean Patrick O'Malley was installed as the new archbishop. O'Malley replaces Cardinal Bernard Law, who resigned in December after admitting that he reassigned priests to new parishes, even though they'd been accused of abusing children. The Vatican is hoping that O'Malley's installation will be the beginning of a new era for the beleaguered Boston Archdiocese, where church attendance is down, Catholic schools are closing, and 250 priests have been accused of molesting children over a period that spans more than four decades. Here is the new archbishop speaking at his ceremony earlier today.
I again ask forgiveness for all the harm done to young people by clergy, religious, and hierarchy. The whole Catholic community is ashamed and anguished because of the pain and the damage inflicted on so many young people and because of our inability or unwillingness to deal with the crime of sexual abuse of minors.
WBUR's Tony Randolph is at the Cathedral of the Holy Cross in Boston. She's been there all morning. And Tony, hearing that answers my first question. It seems as if the new archbishop didn't shy away from the scandals.
No, he got right to the point pretty early in his homily and said that this was something that was wrong, and he asked forgiveness from the victims as well as their families, and said he wants to try to make the church a safe place for young people.
Well, tell us a little bit about what happened this morning. First of all, who wasn't there that might have been expected to be there? Who was there?
Governor Romney was invited, but he did not attend. His staff said that he was on vacation. Senator Kerry was here, although he wasn't expected to be here because he was campaigning in Iowa. Other people who were here include Senator Kennedy, Mayor Menino, the Speaker of the House for the Massachusetts Legislature, and a few other elected officials.
So the scandals didn't keep them away either. But what about the protesters and those who had been abused by priests?
Some of the victims had been invited. Not many of them took the invitation. Some of them decided to go outside instead, and others weren't invited at all and stood outside instead, protesting and saying that they weren't necessarily willing to give Archbishop O'Malley a chance because they feel as though they've been waiting so long already that there's not enough time to wait anymore.
By the way, did the new Archbishop mention his predecessor in his address?
He did not mention Cardinal Law. Cardinal Law had been invited, by the way, and he declined his invitation because of the emotional damage it might cause for some of the victims of clergy sex abuse.
And we hear that this was a much more low-key affair than when Cardinal Law was brought into his office, that Archbishop O'Malley wore the brown robe of his Franciscan order under the more elaborate robing of the Archbishop.
Archbishop O'Malley wanted to have this be a low-key event, not as much hoopla as would normally be involved in the installation of an archbishop. And an example is that normally all of the archbishops from across the country are invited to such an occasion, and in this case only three were invited. He just thought that because of the situation in which he's taking over the archdiocese, it didn't require the type of hoopla that normally goes along with such an event.
And yet we know one protester held a sign, different robes, same secret. So there will be continued discussion about the future of the Catholic Church. Tony, thank you.
You're welcome.
WBUR's Tony Randolph spoke to us from the Cathedral of the Holy Cross in Boston, where Father Sean Patrick O'Malley was installed today as Archbishop.
Also this week, the Vatican is launching a worldwide campaign against legal acceptance of same-sex marriages. Just 6 months ago, the Church issued a set of guidelines reminding Catholic politicians of the Vatican's non-negotiable position on issues including abortion, euthanasia, and civil unions. All of which leads to a new version of an old question. How does a Catholic politician decide on a vote of conscience? Well, joining us on the line is former Vermont Representative Cheryl Hooker, who voted for civil unions 3 years ago, despite threatening phone calls and letters calling her a disgrace to Catholics in Vermont. And Cheryl, that must have been a difficult choice for you.
Well, it was a very emotional time, a very trying time in some respects.
And did you hear from your bishop on this issue as it was being discussed and debated in the legislature?
I didn't hear personally from the bishop. Certainly when I went to church, I heard a lot about it from the pulpit.
So did you feel as if you were getting a lot of pressure from inside and outside your church?
Certainly, certainly. And it was evident in the amount of security that had to be increased at the State House because there were groups of people who were there.
Mm-hmm. And how difficult was it for you as a practicing Catholic to vote the other way for civil unions?
That's a good question, because as a practicing Catholic and receiving many, many calls and many letters against civil unions, many rather frightening messages on my answering machine when I'd get home on the weekends. It was a very difficult thing. I've always practiced my faith, and it was a very trying time. However, I did feel that this was a question of equal rights. I really had to look at what the Constitution said, and then getting into a more, maybe a more fundamental level, thinking about the concept of relationships and commitment and love. And
so in this case, it was a matter of your conscience directed you to do something that was not in keeping with the church's
exactly.
teaching. And what finally happened?
We passed civil unions.
But were people angry with you?
Some were, yes. And the result was that there had been four of us who were Democratic representatives from the city of Rutland, and the election came up in November, and that was the issue. The other three lost their seats.
How much does this whole argument remind you of the kinds of things that were said back when John F. Kennedy was running for president? There were questions raised at the time whether he would be a pawn of the Vatican.
Well, you know, when I think about it, Gail, when I think about how much the church has gone through and the things that the church has had to deal with and Catholics have had to deal with and the discrimination that Catholics have felt, and when I think about what the church is standing for or should stand for, the acceptance and openness, I have to say that it's kind of contradictory. So I think that bore a lot of similarities to that question as to, you know, who's going to have the power.
Well, Cheryl Hooker, thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Thank you, Gail.
Cheryl Hooker is a former representative from Rutland, Vermont.
Still to come, we'll be cooking up some corn fritters with Chef Kathy Gunst.
You're listening to Here and Now.
We learned a lot from a story in today's Boston Globe by writer Stan Grossfeld. Did you know that after a Yankee pitcher beaned and killed a player in 1920, doctored baseballs were outlawed? But without a few scruffs, new baseballs were too slippery. So a guy named Lena Blackburn came up with the perfect solution. Mud. Not just any mud. Mud from a creek in New Jersey. The creek's location and the secret mud mix recipe were passed down to Jim Bintliff, now owner of Lena Blackburn's Baseball Rubbing Mud. And Jim joins us on the line. Jim, describe your mud for us.
It would be the consistency of cold cream or chocolate pudding, and that's actually what it looks like. It looks like a bowl of chocolate pudding.
What does the mud do that's so special to the baseball?
Mud removes the factory gloss off the cover of the baseball without damaging the cover in any way.
And it doesn't come off on your hands, and it doesn't color the ball?
The ball gets a very faint kind of a tan color to it. If you see the ball from a distance, you don't know that it's been rubbed.
Right. And you're not getting rich off this mud.
Getting rich?
Yeah.
No, I still work a full-time job. In fact, I work night shift. I just got off of work about an hour and a half ago.
So what's in it for you?
What's in it for me? The love of baseball. I get treated real well when I go to the Hall of Fame.
Your mud's in the Hall of Fame.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, sure.
I get little perks like I can buy tickets for the World Series game no matter where it's at. I can go to see the Hall of Fame game, which is always a sold-out game, mm-hmm. and knowing that they need my mud to play ball.
Yes, they do. Well, Jim, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jim Bintliff, producer of the baseball rubbing mud used in every major league ball game, and boy, Jim's mud was flying last night in Texas, where Red Sox third baseman Bill Miller, facing the Rangers, drove in 11 home runs, but also had a first in baseball, hitting two grand slams, one from each side of the plate. Bill Littlefield of NPR's Only a Game joins us in the studio, and Bill, how big is this?
Well, it's big in the sense that you don't see a lot of switch hitters hitting grand slams from each side of the plate.
It feels to me like Paul Bunyan coming to bat. I mean, how do you hit a grand slam off each side of the plate?
Well, it's a good question, especially to somebody like me who had trouble making contact from the right side of the plate exclusively, who couldn't imagine switching to the other side of the plate. You do it by dint of determination, turning yourself into a switch hitter. But, of course, the opportunity to hit a home run with the bases loaded from each side of the plate depends on a great many variables over which you have no control at all.
Taking out the switch hitting part, Bill Mullers becomes the 12th player in Major League history just to hit two grand slams in a game, you know, take out the switch hitting. What does this do to him? What does this elevate him to?
It means that he'll have a hard time, perhaps, coming to bat tonight and thinking of something less glorious and glamorous. But, you know, you also win games by popping a bloop over the shortstop's head or walking with the bases loaded.
But especially with this player, he was just recently traded to the Sox because in certain corners they didn't think he was all that great. He was traded away. So I'm not going to mention that other guy whose last name is a girl's name, Ruth. You know, but some are hoping there's another one on the horizon in Bill Miller.
Well, I think the very best thing that could happen for the Red Sox is that somebody else entirely steps up. That really would be the best thing that could happen.
Right. Unless, of course, you're from Texas. Bill, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Bill Littlefield of NPR's Only a Game.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
And we have come down to the kitchen. That's because it's Wednesday, and we're joining resident chef and cookbook author Kathy Gunst for a lesson in what to do with some of the fresh vegetables that I know I've been harvesting, not. Kathy, you have been frittering away here in the kitchen. I couldn't resist.
Fritter. Yes. Hi. Good to see you
we're
all.
We're not sure if that's where the word comes from, frittering away, maybe about making fritters.
But sounds reasonable.
But nonetheless, that's
I think we can say it is. Yeah. Right here, right now.
We have decided that.
That's right.
And now.
We have just defined fritter.
Tell us about making some fritters.
Well, this is corn season. It's just starting now. We're just heading into August. And as far as I'm concerned, there's really only about 6 weeks of the year to eat corn because the rest of the year, when they ship stuff in from, you know, unless you live in Florida and you get it year round, it doesn't taste like anything worth eating. What happens when you pick an ear of corn is that all those beautiful natural sugars turn to starch the minute it's picked.
So you better race for the house.
I mean, I don't know if you've ever seen this, but I have seen this. I have seen in huge fields of corn, farmers going out with a huge pot of boiling water, bringing the kitchen to the field, strip the corn, you throw it in. By the time you walk back to the house to the table, the corn is ready.
You know, I've done worse, and I'm sure we're going to get letters from people saying this is a bad thing to do, but I've eaten corn raw.
Why is that bad?
Okay,
it's
good.
Fabulous. That's one of the great ways to know if corn is really fresh. Now, I have corn here that was picked this morning, and I haven't shucked it yet. You can see that the silk at the top is just starting to dry out, but it's not dead and limp, and it doesn't look like it's 2 days old. People always say to me, how do you know what the really fresh corn is? Well, I like to shop at a farmer's market or at a vegetable stand where they'll let you touch or, you know, test one.
Can't you just do that in a supermarket? Can't you just rip open?
They generally don't like it, but I'll show you what I do if they let me. The other thing is, if you're going to buy it for a crowd, buy one ear of corn. What is it, 25 cents, 40 cents? And here's what I do to test it. Okay, listen to the sound, because this is very much about sound. I'm going to peel it. And you hear that kind of squeaky, fresh sound there? If this were really old and dried out, you wouldn't get that sound. And now what I do, and this again might bother some listeners, but I take my fingernail and I push it into a kernel, and juice pops out. And that tells me that this is an exceedingly fresh piece of corn.
And that's yours.
That's my little trick. Yes. No, Robin, now don't you want to bite raw? The other thing you can do, of course, It's just eat it raw. It doesn't have any starchiness.
No, it's very
it's
sweet.
It's delicious.
Isn't it?
It's incredibly sweet. I think it's. I love to make a raw corn salad where you just shuck it off the cob and you add chopped tomatoes and sweet pepper. And my mouth fills with corn soup. But today.
That's the end of the segment. Thank you very much.
That's
bye.
Right.
I'm just going to go eat raw corn.
All right.
It's good.
Let's shuck another one. Listen to the sound. Listen to the freshness. Okay, if you buy it at a supermarket and it's been shipped across many state lines, you're not going to get that sound. It's going to just kind of peel right off because it's so old. Yeah, what's that?
I mean, it looks fresh. It doesn't look sort of dull and old.
Exactly. I mean, the kernels here, this is young corn. This is the beginning of the season. And we have white and yellow kernels. And they're very fresh looking. And you can see by just looking at it, this is juicy corn. That's what you're looking for. Often in supermarkets, they will have one or two ears stripped there. A supermarket is not the place to buy corn in August.
I know, but sometimes you have to.
I mean, it's like growing up in a strawberry field and going, taking it out of your freezer. It's like, go for the freshly harvested corn.
Okay.
Okay, so let's shuck one more here. Now, we're going to shuck our corn, and then what we're going to do is we're going to cut it off the cob, which is an extremely simple process, but I think it's one... It scares some people.
Well, don't they make those little cobber things where you
they
can put
do,
the
but you know, it's yet another. Oops, my pan's getting very hot. It's yet another gizmo that you have to go out and buy. So I'm going to tell you how to do it. You shuck the ear of corn. You place it down on a chopping board, or let's do it right inside a bowl.
Okay,
so
standing straight up.
Standing straight up. Your hands on the top. You're going to take a very sharp knife. Careful of your fingers.
That is a huge knife.
It is. This is my favorite. And we're going to just slice down. And it comes right off in these wonderful rows.
Now, you're getting a little cob, but you don't worry
about
that. Very little.
Very little. You just want to be careful here. And for the fritters, I'm going to do four ears of corn. This is a recipe that you can make a tiny bit of, or you can make tons of it and have it all ready for a party. Now, another trick, don't throw away the cobs. What's left inside this cob after we've sliced off the kernels is a lot of juice and flavor. Make a corn chowder. You can make a beautiful corn stock by just throwing all your corn cobs into a pot, a little bit of water, some parsley, maybe celery, peppercorn, salt. Let it simmer for about 15 minutes. Take out the cobs, and you have the base of a fabulous chowder.
Great. Okay. Or you can give it to the dog. But that's a whole other
thing. Or the chickens.
Right.
Okay, here we go. Here's cob number two. So again, I'm just slicing down, and all the kernels are coming right off, and you can see the juice squirting out. That is a very happy sign. And I'm making a lovely music here.
How much would you say? I mean, can you give us a ratio of corn to fritters?
Generally, each cob, you can get about a cup of kernels from each cob. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we're going to do four whole cobs here. There we go. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, this fritter recipe is so incredibly simple. We're going to add one cup of flour.
The corn.
Yep. We have four ears of corn that we've shucked off the cob. All right. Kel, you want to stir for me here?
Sure.
All right. That would be great. One cup of flour. We're going to add... We're going to add a teaspoon of baking powder, and this is going to help our fritters rise a little bit. You know, we never really explain, a fritter is like a pancake, but this is an extremely light one that really pays homage to the freshness of corn.
Which you would have to be something that we would eat in the summer, right? Because
exactly.
I normally think of it as something you'd eat in the winter.
Exactly. This is not heavy, it's not gobbed with sugar, it's not deep fried, so we're going to add 2/3 a cup of half and half cream. And now, there are two ways to do this. You can do a sweet version where you add a touch of sugar and then you cook them with maple syrup. But I'm going to make a savory one. We're going to add a good handful of chopped parsley. We're using all the fresh herbs from the garden, making the most of the best of summer food.
Nice and mushy.
Yes,
here,
keep
right?
stirring. You're
very
doing a beautiful job. Mushy is a very technical food term. What I'm doing while Gail mushes the corn fritter is I'm adding a tablespoon of chives, thyme, basil, and parsley.
Sounds like whatever you've got.
Exactly. You can add rosemary. You can add lemon thyme. You could add scallions. Okay, so we've got, here we go. Let's get our pan here. We've got that. We've got 1 tablespoon of melted butter. We're going to add that. And then we got our skillet heating up here. And that's all you do. This batter can be made ahead of time. And what I've done also is I've made an herb butter with all the same herbs, mushed, another technical word, mushed into a... a butter so that we, and I freeze that, and then we slice it up on top of these corn fritters. So we have a nice hot pan.
It's just like making pancakes up from here on out.
Exactly, but it's so much lighter. It's not as the usual amount of flour. We're adding a touch of salt and pepper, and now you're going to add a heaping tablespoon to a hot skillet with a little bit of melted butter.
So don't shape it, just
no,
put it
on
should, the skillet.
It's free form. I mean, this summer cooking is not about fussy perfection. These are, they can be as small or as large as you want, and they cook for about 2 minutes on each side, and then they're done. You serve them hot. They make a fabulous appetizer.
And what I love is that you can add or subtract anything. You can make them, as you said, sweet with nutmeg or bananas, or you can make them more savory with potatoes.
If you want to make them sweet, you just add a little bit of sugar and serve them with maple syrup. But I love the fresh herbs. 2 minutes on each side, they're done. You can chew them while you do the credits. That is
Alrighty. As
simple as can be. Corn fritters with herb butter.
And don't forget, to get the basic recipe and to learn more about corn, just go to our website, here-now.org. As usual, Kathy explains it for you. Kathy, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Eat off air.
Please,
you
will chew, because they're done.
They're done.
That's how fast they are.
They're done. Flip them, they're done. Thanks so much, Kathy.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
And Kathy Gunst. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and more Here and Now.
It's another good year for the farmers in Afghanistan, the ones growing opium poppies.
We'll look at what that means to Washington's war on drugs.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.